Bonane and yes, Gemma. So it's a very fascinating subject, of course, and very beautiful way to start the new year. So when Sri Aurobindo was asked by Nagin Doshi that in this life you have come as avatar, and what were you doing in your previous lives? So Sri Aurobindo says, we include Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So he says, we were there as vibhutis. So he asked, what were you doing as vibhutis? So Sri Aurobindo says, carrying on the evolution. And then he asked that, what does it mean? So Sri Aurobindo says, to speak of that, I will have to write the history of the world. So it's very interesting because there are two ways of looking at any event actually. And one can apply it anywhere from modern physics to, how the nerve cells, brain cells conduct and how things happen in one's own life. And of course, to history itself. And it's one is to see each event as separate from each other. So we can take this cue as if, like particles streaming. Each particle is separate from each other and it's flowing, creating a pattern. But the other way is to look at it as wave. So there is a continuity through which things are flowing. And when we look at it like wave, then we get a little more truer idea of what things are happening, how things are happening. So wave rises and then falls and rises and falls. So too we see civilizations rise and fall. It happens in individual life also. The beauty is that the rise as well as the fall both impel the creation forward. So this first thing to remember, that we often lament the fall of something or the collapse of something. But actually it's to pick up momentum for the next level. It's for a greater rise. So these moments, when there are critical moments in history, when things have to take a crucial turn. So that's what Sri Aurobindo calls as the hour of God. And the mother speaks about it. We are at one of those hours of God. And during these hours of God, a lot of change takes place in an unprecedented way. Often during that period, people do not really recognize or understand the importance of that moment. It's much later, may not be much later, but almost later, certainly after the event is over and when all those pandits who were, trying to analyze and understand, when they are gone, then you see the change it effectuated. So that's what Sri Aurobindo is referring to in these four great events. I'll read the aphorism first. But what we need to understand is that there are many minor events which also have an effect. But these are the four events which Sri Aurobindo speaks as very great events. And another interesting thing is, when we look at these events, in some way or the other, Sri Aurobindo was present as a vibhuti during all of these events. So when he is speaking about it, he is not saying as if he is looking at history from outside and, now analyzing and giving his conclusions. He has been with those events and there are reasons to say that. But we'll first read the aphorism. There are four very great events, not just great events, but very great events in history. The siege of Troy, the life and crucifixion of Christ, the exile of Krishna in Vrindavan, and the colloquy with Arjun on the field of Kurukshetra. So these are the four great events he speaks about. The fifth great event I'll come to, very great event I'll come to later. The siege of Troy created Hellas. The exile in Vrindavan created devotional religion, in brackets, for before there was only meditation and worship. Christ from his cross humanized Europe. The colloquy at Kurukshetra will yet liberate humanity. Yet it is said that none of these four events ever happened. So first there is a dig at history, that history often documents events which are very outwardly seeming very important, but there is another line of events which are taking place which history may not document fully for various reasons. For example, during the time of Christ, how many would be documenting? It's much later that people know the effect of Christ. Similarly, we know in Vrindavan when Sri Krishna is hiding, of course the Purana speaks about it, but modern mind has a tendency to declare them all as myths. So this is one of the biggest challenges, because history wants to see concrete proofs. Now, imagine Siege of Troy is taking place when? It's about 12th century BC, around that period. So, to dig out historical evidences, though they have found few things, like the cup of Menelaus apparently, but they are very scanty. Similarly, about the Mahabharata war, taking place about 4500 BC. I am just talking of the rough idea. Similarly, of course, Christ is relatively new, 2000 years, but very difficult to find that kind of evidence as history, is looking for. In India, of course, we had a very interesting thing. It was folklore and oral tradition. So the history was preserved through folklore and oral tradition, which is something very wonderful. But coming to these events, so why is Shobindu speaking of these very great events? So the siege of Troy. So what happened during siege of Troy and why nature allowed, what was the deeper significance of it? So before that we see that Troy is a very developed, it's a very developed in its own right, a dynasty or a kingdom. But this Troy is like a fort within which a very highly civilized and developed people are living. Priam and many others. Priam is the king, and then his son Hector and Paris, etc., etc. And many other, Deiphobus and, Enyard and many Greek heroes are living there. They are legendary. They have conversation with gods and they are like superheroes of today. So that is a kind of civilization. Whereas all around, there are tribes who are, okay, developed. They have their own story, but they are all like isolated in small little pockets. Now what happens, as Shobindu later reveals to us, that history for a long period will not allow this. Why? Because it's an, like, she loves all her children and she wants all of us to be uplifted together. This has great significance and I'll talk about it later. So what happened is that there is a background to the Trojan War, and the background is that Paris is roaming around with cowherds men. He has been apparently cast out, and while he is there, suddenly all the goddesses appear. There is a kind of party and all the goddesses come, but there is one goddess who is known as the goddess who creates disorder or chaos. Now it's very interesting, she is also a goddess. Even chaos is divinely planned, but she is not allowed to enter in that august gathering because she will disrupt everything. So as the doors are shut, she slips through the door a puzzle. And the puzzle is about, who is the fairest of us all. So that person will get a prize. This goddess will give a prize. Whichever is the fairest goddess, she is now to give a prize to whoever guesses correctly. Now everybody is silent because this is a puzzle thrown through the door. Who is the fairest of us all? Now all the goddesses have asked and nobody is now willing to say anything because they all know if they speak a word, they will earn the ire of all other gods and goddesses. This story is interestingly, very humorously remarked by Shobindu in one of his letters. And the letter goes like this, that Dilip Kumar Roy, I think he asked, which is a greater art, literature or poetry or music? And he says, you want me to be in the position of Paris, who will say one and all the other, out of the 9 muses, all the other 8 will start closing the embroidery department, closing this department. It is believed generally that he himself was Paris. This is what, if you read Setna's things, you'll find. And Helen was none else but an incarnation of Divine Mother. So Paris suddenly raises his hand. He says, I can tell. He says, who? He says, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, is the fairest. And now, because he has chosen, Aphrodite grants him a boon that the most beautiful woman on earth, she will fall in love with you. Now, the most beautiful woman is Helen, about whom it is said, the face that launched 1,000 ships upon the sea. And then the story unfolds and Paris goes to Agamemnon's kingdom, and where he befriends his brother Menelaus' wife Helen, and they both fall in love, and then she crosses the threshold and they sail through the ship. And then when they come to know, so Menelaus along with Odysseus, they try to get her back by diplomatic means. It fails, to cut a long story short. Then the tribes unite. See, now what the first step is that all the tribes unite. And in that, there are several heroes. Now, very interestingly, Homer, who has written Iliad, he is mainly writing Iliad to praise Achilles, who is the real war hero. I mean, I am resisting the temptation because this is a story very dear to my heart also. So Achilles, and how Aurobindo says that he is like a war machine and later on changes into a very compassionate being. So very fascinating story. So they go, the battle lasts for 9 years. They are besieging the fort, but they cannot enter. They are unable to enter. And they don't know what to do. And meanwhile, the gods have decided. All the gods have turned against, this Paris, because he has chosen Aphrodite over others. So slowly all these gods are stopping to help, though some of them are standing on either side. Like Athena is with Odysseus now. She is our Maheshwari, and some aspect of Durga is there. She says, I'll stand by the side of Odysseus. So all these major gods are now with the people, tribes which have gathered. And then they attack. 9 years, nothing happens. Then 1 year, the real battle takes place. Homer covers mainly the last 4 days of the battle, not the whole battle, and mainly where Achilles comes into the play. And then, well, the fate is almost sealed. Well, to cut a long story short, the tribes play a game. They seem to retreat, but actually they leave a horse, as if wooden horse, as if to sacrifice, as a sacrificial horse they have left. And then the Trojans, who are very happy about their victory, they believe that now the ships have sailed away. But this was a strategy by Odysseus. And then they take the horse in as if it's a booty left by them, war trophy, not realizing that's where the cash lied. And inside the horse, it was a big horse they had built. They were 25 or 50 real Greek heroes, including Odysseus. So then at night, these people are drunk. That's when these heroes come out, open the doors of the fort, and a very bloody battle takes place. And in that battle, many things happen. Achilles dies, Paris dies, Helen, who has, after the death, marries Deiphobus. Then Deiphobus also dies. Then Menelaus wants to kill her. This is a very interesting part of the story. And when he sees Helen again, the whole war he has fought, and he wants to kill Helen, because of which all this has happened. But when he sees Helen, he falls in love again. And the two come back, and they live happily ever after. So this is one part of the story. But what happened after that war, and that's what Aurobindo is referring to, that there was a collapse of a very high and mighty civilization, extremely developed. But then there was a generalization of a certain kind of culture. So they were a cultured humanity, extremely cultured. You see, in India also we face through a similar situation. And it has a relevance to the ashram context also. So there was a highly cultured people, and they were largely people who were tribes, who were good, all kinds of people. But then suddenly that there was a leveling effect. And therefore, with that leveling effect, a composite culture came into existence, a Greek culture which had the touch of the Romans, and this culture came to be known as Hellas. So this, in the Greece till date, they don't like to be called as Greeks. They like to be called as Hellas. They identify with that. That's their culture. So, like we should also, like we, if somebody calls us Bharatiya, now this is our culture. India may be a name which people have given to a similar situation. So we call them Greeks and we call it Greece, but they don't call it as Greece or Greeks, but they call it as Hellas. So Hellas, which Aurobindo is referring to, is a composite culture which developed now, you know, because Priam's kingdom was developed, but all other places were much less. So all of them developed music, art, poetry, some of those sculpture, if you see, amazing. I mean, the sense of beauty, physical culture, all this developed subsequent to that. So it created a kind of, there was a destruction of an empire or a kingdom, a very, very powerful king and a noble king. Priam is not an ordinary person. He's an extremely noble person. But that's not what Nietzsche wants. Nietzsche wants that everybody should develop it. And therefore we see that a leveling effect takes place, but that leveling effect eventually has far-reaching consequences. So this is the event, and as I said, in all likelihood, Aurobindo himself was Paris, Dilip Kumar Roy was Hector. Aurobindo notes it in one of the his records of yoga. And when Dilip Kumar Roy came to know, he was very unhappy because Hector was dragged by Achilles 7 times around the fort after, you know, he was killed. Because Hector had killed Patroclus's nephew. Anyways, that's going into the story too far and deep. So siege of Troy, what did it create? He says it created Hellas. So a composite culture. Then the next is the life and crucifixion of Christ. So elsewhere, Shubhendu also writes that, you know, one of the aphorisms that the Germans, they praise like Caesar's death created, it was a very important event in history, very important event. But Christ's crucifixion was a much greater event, though historians regard it still as, did it take place, whether it took place the way it is described or not. So all this, there are doubts in history. So mother was asked that what really he is referring to with regard to Caesar and Christ. Now if you see, this whole event is taking place within 200-300 years. So there were republics, this Rome was a republic, and then this dynasty came, not exactly a dynasty, but Julius Caesar is one of those key figures. So Julius Caesar is a very dictatorial, autocratic king, and Mark Antonio and Brutus, his friend, and 26 others, they conspire. They want to kill him so that they can once again bring back the republic. This is the intention, that we'll establish the republic and finish a dictator. But see what happens when Julius Caesar falls. So the mantle goes to his adopted son, Octavio. So they were adopting children, not by dynasty. So that Octavio, when he takes over, literally a change comes over him. He who was fairly like most of the Romans during that time, and that is relevance to Christ's story, pretty cruel. If you see the gladiators and their way of life, and it was like ruthless military, that's how they could siege so many empires. I mean, if you even as late as when we look at the Byzantine Empire, and pretty cruel, till they were thrown away by a still more cruel Ottoman Empire. I mean, if you see the history. So when Julius Caesar falls and Augustus Caesar comes, he is named Augustus as somebody royal, August, that's how. His name is Octavio, and he takes the mantle of Caesar. Now, again, Augustus Caesar is supposed to be Shurbindo, a vibhuti of Shurbindo. His birth is also, if I remember right, is 15th August. And he brought in many reforms. He is regarded as one of the most important. In fact, it started the Roman Empire with Augustus Caesar. So the result was completely opposite to what was expected. So what was expected was that the republic will come back. They didn't know that God has another person up their sleeve, and it was Augustus Caesar, who happened to be such a powerful emperor that the Roman Empire spread all the way to Turkey, all the way to Egypt, and again a new kind of composite culture began to develop, which today we know as the Greco-Roman culture. So this is how things were began to spread out, and it is regarded as the most peaceful reign. Like we talk of golden period in Indian history as the Chandragupta Maurya's empire, but similarly, Augustus Caesar is known to usher in a golden, peaceful empire. Why peaceful? Because nobody would have the capacity to fight against him, and his subjects were very happy. There are many reforms he brought in. Now, that's a whole story, and that's again Shurbindo. But when Augustus Caesar withdraws, when he dies, again he has an adopted son, Tiberius. So he becomes the next emperor, another Caesar. And he's the one, and his, not directly, but one of his governors, I think it was Pilate, who was behind Christ's crucifixion. So now on one side, there is the Roman Empire, which continues for almost 300-400 years untouched. But soon after the crucifixion of Christ, within 200-300 years, in the same Greco-Roman or Roman Empire, there comes a man called Constantine. That's the event Shurbindu is referring to. Now, Constantine is a small town fellow who is born, you know, somewhere around Italy. So now we have these countries, but that was not the case then. So he is somewhere around that, you know, from a small place, and his mother comes from a very modest background. So Constantine, when he takes the mantle of the empire, though he is an emperor, powerful emperor, he took over his empire after some kind of a revolt within the whole section. He overthrew the then emperor, because the people supported him by people's choice. And then when he became the emperor, he turns towards Christ. There's a whole story about it, and it is said that his mother himself was a Christian who was instrumental in turning him towards Christ. Now, when that happened, before that we see a very brutal, cruel kind of Roman Empire, except during the reign of Augustus, change had started coming. Before that, we see the kings, the Roman kings, very cruel. But from Augustus Caesar, the empire starts, and with that, a more liberal outlook, a large, wider sense begins to emerge. And then with Constantine, like, he stopped persecution of the Christians, and he, you know, instituted Christianity as a kind of state religion. And because of that patronage and spread of Christ's gospel of love, compassion, the humanity around Europe, which was basically extremely warring, pretty ruthless, they began to start getting humanized. These human values through the great sacrifice of Christ. I mean, it's not a... Imagine in that state, someone is saying from the cross that forgive them, for they know not what they are doing. So it had such a repercussion, and I'm sure occult repercussions. That's why Shubindu says, though Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar, these events are well known. Germans and historians agree about these events. But the crucifixion, life and crucifixion of Christ is, you know, there are many loose ends, and it's regarded as partly fiction, partly true. But the impact of the crucifixion was that a whole Europe was humanized. So he humanized Europe. On one side, Augustus Caesar established the empire, a good empire, but the humanization waited for the release of energies of compassion after the death of Christ. So these values started getting spread all over Europe. So this is the second part, second event which is speaking of that the life and crucifixion of Christ. And what did it create? Christ from his cross humanized Europe. So it brought in that compassion, charity. Then the third event is the exile of Krishna in Vrindavan. So that we know that because Krishna is born in Mathura in the prison of Kansa, and then he is taken to Vrindavan where he grows up. Now, the beauty of that period, and that's why I keep saying, recently also we had a conference on the Vedas, and people try to end up that, yes, no doubt Vedas' fundamental truths are there, but there is something that Krishna brought, which is, well, in a sense implicit in Vedas, but not explicit. So with the coming of Christ, with the coming of Krishna, his exile in Vrindavan, we know that his exploit, the gop and gopis were celestial beings who had landed up there to awaken earth to bhakti. So there is no bhakti until then. And suddenly Krishna's presence in Vrindavan, because he is the eternal charmer, because he is full of that delight and love, because he is the charming divine flute player, we see so many stories wherein all these gop and gopi, who were themselves incarnations of godly beings, they came together, and there was such a release of streams of bhakti that till date we are bathing in those streams. So before that, Shobhita says there is meditation and worship, which is how we see in worship. By worship he is referring to the karma kand of the Vedas. So there is ritualistic worship, which is what he is referring to, the karma kand, which we see particularly in Vedism, as it is called sometimes, and sometimes the Purva Mimamsa, where there is the ritualistic worship. And there was meditation, which we see in the Upanishad. So if you divide these two, karma kand and gyan kand, you can broadly say that one is about worship, the other is about meditation. Both are valid paths. There should not be a quarrel between the two. But Sri Krishna brought a much more direct contact with the divine. And that contact is that, well, through love, through devotion, through surrender, you can entirely arrive at communion and union with the divine. So he gave to earth the great path of love and surrender, for which we are forever grateful to Sri Krishna. And Shubhita speaks of that, the exile of Krishna in Vrindavan. And what did it do? The exile in Vrindavan created devotional religion, for before there was only meditation and worship. And the last event that he speaks of, the colloquy with Arjun on the field of Kurukshetra, will yet liberate humanity. So we know colloquy is the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna on on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. But the beauty of that dialogue is, what is interesting is, if you really see before that dialogue takes place, you know, there is no clarity about when we act, what should be the basis of our action. And because of this confusion, pandits have even gone on to declare, including, you know, based on the Upanishads, though the Ishopanishads speak about Kurvanne Vihe Karmani, doing works verily in the world, we should seek to live 100 years. But there are pandits who deliberately have twisted the words and said works are necessary only to reach a point where ultimately you can get liberated. And what works? The works were mainly the ritualistic works. So it created a schism in, you know, in the thought, wherein there was one, the works of ordinary life, and there were special kind of works like puja, home and all these things. But here is Shri Krishna, who joined all works into the great mainstream of liberation. So when Shri Aurobindo says we'll yet liberate humanity, is because now nothing is left. All works can become a means for liberation. Not only that, he goes one step further, and when he says Nistra Guna Bhava Sabhe Sachi, he says that even after liberation, you can still continue to act in the world. This is a very interesting thought. Well, if we go into the nitty-gritty, you know, people can debate that, no, it is there in the Vedas, it's there in the Upanishad, it's there, but it's not developed to that extent. So, because, you know, you have the Samhitas, you have the Brahmanas, but here it is developed to the fullest extent. Whatever work we may be doing, wherever we may be, whatever our occupation, profession, we don't have to be pandit doing ritualistic aspects. We can do that, nothing wrong about it. But we can be doing any work and it will become a wide path of liberation. And therefore he says that the Gita is, that's why it's so relevant to today's times. See, it's very difficult to take out 1 hour or 2 hours and do Homa, Puja. People do it. All credit to them and kudos to them. But still, it's not easy. It's not easy even to find spaces to build proper Yajnashalas the way, you know, they used to do it. That was genuine. But it's not easy because the spirit of time takes humanity into many directions. But today, what can be practiced is things like remember and offer, dedicated, consecrated action, Satat Smaran, Nitya Samarpan, all this is possible, Nishkam Karma, all this is very much possible, doable, and the beauty is that therefore, doing all kinds of works, we can arrive at liberation. So that's why he uses the word, we'll yet liberate humanity, because its potential is such. I mean, you may have limitations on, as I said, on the Karm Kand Puja, because, you know, you need special space. Now there are people who are living in very small places, and it's not easy to always, you know, do a yajna the way it is prescribed. But the Gita's path, it reaches to all, applies to all. So these are the four great events. Now I have added a fifth great event. So in all these events, we'll see there is a sudden change. Now in Krishna's event particularly, again we see there is a collapse of the dynasties. There were three dynasties during that time. So one is the Kuru dynasty, the second is Magadha dynasty, very strong, and third is the Yadav dynasty. And what does Shri Krishna do? Shri Aurobindo says in one of his writings, in Bangla writing, through the Mahabharata war, Shri Krishna saved India. So all the arrogant Kshatriyas, again we see, siege of Troy, end of heroic age, end of myths, end of, you know, meeting the gods, all that is gone. After that you don't see people like you see in Homer when he recounts, Odysseus is meeting Athena, he is having a problem with Poseidon, or, you know, Cassandra is having those visions, and the god Apollo is siding, whispering gently into the ear of, you know, what is to be done. So all this we do not find after that. It's like the age has turned or begun to turn into Kali Yuga. Now in India again we see that all this ceases before the Mahabharata war. We see the there are heroes, and these heroes are in communication with God. Gods, I mean, Arjun is communicating with Indra. Karna is communicating with Surya Devta. Kunti herself is communicating. But then soon thereafter, there is the dark ages start, or the Kali Yuga. India is the last, as we can see, to enter into Kali Yuga. For that, right, it has started earlier. And that's why we see during the phase of Kali Yuga, we see avatars coming more frequently. We see Christ, Shri Krishna, Buddha, and now Shri Aurobindo. Now what happens with Sri Aurobindo? All this Kali Yuga where the gods are sealed to the human vision, the heroism, the high nobility, all that has been leveled. And this leveling was required. There was a purpose in doing it. Now, I was saying about the ashram context. This happened even in the ashram. There is a very interesting conversation of the mother in 1957. I think it's 3rd February, but I may be mistaken. Where people say that there is a leveling. The key word is leveling. We see a general leveling in the ashram because they used to see an atmosphere very concentrated, etc. And now, you know, we see that all kinds of people come. So ashramites ask her that, mother, the general consciousness has gone down. Now mother, who was obviously present in all these important events of history, she says, no, general level has not gone down. But yes, earlier there were individuals, just like we see in heroic age, high bred individuals, each one is a hero. But now she says that those individuals, she has joined their consciousnesses with the masses. So the masses have developed or are developing, the general consciousness has become higher, though the individuals, that has come down. So maybe I'll just read a little bit of that because this is important. She says, in August 57, she is saying, but it's about that experience. Somebody asked that, why is it consciousness has come down? So mother says, for a very long time, the ashram was only a gathering of individuals. This is exactly just like we see in during the time of Troy, during the time of Krishna. There are, you know, that's why we see Karna is not allowed to participate. Only, you know, what today goes unfortunately by the name of Brahmanvad. But this was a reason, there was a reason that there was effort to create pure to type. And the only way it could be done was by segregating. So there were people who were very high, rishis and yogis, but the general level was not developed. So people have this mistake in Veda, everybody was a yogi or rishi. No, there are great rishis. But the general level of humanity, though they followed what they were saying because they were very powerful being, and the kings had patron, but you see the average state, even during the reign of Rama, that the average man is still doubting Mata Sita and so on and so forth. So he says that, she says that earlier this was happening. There were individuals, each one representing something, but as an individual and without any collective organization. They were like separate pawns on a chessboard. Now each one progressed or didn't progress. So this is how it was. This lasted a very long time. And then what happens that, and it is only quite recently that the need for a collective reality began to appear, which is not necessarily limited to the ashram, but embraces all who have declared themselves, I don't mean materially, but in their consciousness, to be disciples of Sri Aurobindo and have tried to live his teaching. Among all of them, and more strongly since the supramental manifestation, there is a general rising of consciousness. So this appears as if, so she says that, you know, it's a collective consciousness which is rising. This has caused some disturbance, for the tendency was formerly so individualistic that certain habits have been upset. I don't mean materially, for things are not very different from what they were, but in a somewhat deeper consciousness. And above all, that is the point I want to emphasize, this has created a certain inner interdependence which has naturally lowered the individual level a little, except for those who had already attained an inner realization. And this is what is called leveling. So basically, if we see today, and that's why sometimes I share this, that this is not a time for eulogizing the disciples. Sometimes we do it, but we have to understand now the yoga is going to take a collective turn. So this collective yoga, which is something very unique, we don't see it. We don't see in the age of rishis, they are praying for everybody. There are some rishis who are saying, you know, that let's, and with regard to the rishis that speaking of sangachatvam, sangvadatvam, they are also praying sarve bhavantu sukhina, sarve santu niramaya. But this is a prayer for all. But now it is a yoga which is spreading to all. And this collective yoga, because it's a collective yoga, same thing which has happened earlier, but in a very catastrophic and disastrous way. That's why Sri Aurobindo, now we understand why on 24th November, when she went with an overmind creation, Sri Aurobindo asked the mother to dissolve it. And he says that it'll create a very great religion, greatest of all. There would be some exceptional individuals who will be worshipped like gods. But it is not the solution, because they had seen through it all. That if there is an overmind creation, there will be some who are exceptional. But there will be many who will always be under the shadows of these exceptional individuals. So there has been a leveling, and so now the masses is rising. This is a very interesting thing one can see. And what is that fifth great event from where this started? Now this started with the meeting of the mother and Sri Aurobindo. So that's the fifth great event. And why I specifically speak of this event? Because there are many events even in Sri Aurobindo and the mother's life. For instance, there is the separation of Bengal when Sri Aurobindo entered. And this separation ended up paradoxically uniting. See now what is happening in Bangladesh. Same, there is almost a repetition of that event. There is a kind of, you know, as if Bangladesh is separating itself from it's a independent nation, but it's going to try being with Pakistan. It's going to end up uniting a whole Indian ethos. So, but that's, let's keep it for the future. But what's happening now, as a result of the meeting of mother and Sri Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo said that till the mother had come, he could practice the yoga for himself and arrive at supramental realization. But that we know, we have seen from these events, that that's not enough. So he says, but with the mother's coming, the yoga could become collective. He says, I could help myself, but I couldn't help others. So the yoga actually became collective when the mother agreed or consented. And that's why when 24th April 1920, when she came definitively, she speaks of that event as the tangible sign of the sure victory over the adverse forces. So that event of the meeting of mother and Sri Aurobindo, first on 29th March, but more significantly on 24th April 1920, marks actually, it is the day when we can say with certainty, at some level, it was clear that now, once again, the age is going to turn. See, both, all the three events are turning of an age, all the four events. And now again, the age is going to turn. Now it's going to lift up out of the Kali Yuga, because all the three events are taking place during those moments when this is sliding back towards Kali Yuga, but in different ways. But now we are coming out of the Kali Yuga, out of the dark age, and therefore the mother and Sri Aurobindo's meeting together is the fifth most important event which is going to change things. Because once it started, within 6 years, Sri Aurobindo says, yes, now mission impossible is possible within 6 years. And another 30 years, that means total 36 years, mother declared that the supramental manifestation is now a reality. She spoke about it. And more she said that it's a reality. And therefore she gave messages like it, the hour of God, are you ready, cling to truth. All these messages she started giving, that truth or the abyss, because now a new manifestation has started. Now we will see not few heroes, as we read during the time of, let's say, the Trojan War, or during the time of the Roman Empire, or during the time of Kurukshetra War. Now we are going to see many, many, many individuals who are going to cross a critical barrier. At least I am seeing them when they ask questions on Ask Alokda, 10-year-old, 9-year-old, 11-year-old children. And when I see their questions, 20-year-old, 19-year-old, 23-year-old, 24-year-old, these are the children of the future. And one can see it. They don't even know who they are or what they are. And unless you are really had a gone through, like, you know, people like us who have gone through a whole rigmarole and you arrive at some point, they don't know who they are. They're very unsure of themselves very often. They don't know why they are, because they are misunderstood. But it's very clear these are the new children. And these are not belonging to any specific family, dynasty, that, you know, because parents were turned, therefore none of these criteria is applying. And they can be here in Pondicherry, they can be elsewhere, they could be a student here, they could be a student in Timbuktu, they could be in a village in Odisha, they could be in, you know, upscale New York, New Jersey. So none of this applies. So what we are seeing now is this not just a collective evolution, but a collective revolution. Again, like all the four great events, that time their value was underscored. Even today, many people don't understand. I mean, if Sri Aurobindo's eyes, we don't see. We may not know. Many of us don't even know the history of the Roman Empire, what happened to Troy. Many of us don't know. It's a very sad thing. Because, as he has said, history regards them as myths. And Sri Aurobindo says that, you know, that thanks to these myths and the gospels, because they have saved the soul alive. Even today, Bhagavad Puran, where you see the Krishna's exploits in Vrindavan, it's regarded as mythology and, you know, that's it. That's the end of the story. What is worst is that we as Indians also end up buying that. But that's a different subject. Someday we'll talk about Bhagavad and Sri Krishna and his life. That how it's so real, so true. It's the both inner story and there's the Krishna as the outer avatar. But that we'll keep it for some other time. For the moment, these are the five events of which the most powerful in my understanding, for the reasons that I'm saying, is the meeting of permanent coming together of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo. This is an event for which creation was waiting. In the age of Rama, we see the separation between Rama and Sita. In the age of Krishna, we see a separation between Krishna and Radha. In the even Krishna and Draupadi, apart from coming together for the work. In the age of Christ, complete separation. I mean, even the church is divided between church which accepts Mary, who is the mother, and the church is dedicated to her, and others who just ignore her. I am not even talking of Mary Magdalene. I am talking about Mother Mary, who is the mother of Christ. So, in the case of Buddha, we see that, you know, the feminine has been ignored. But with the coming together of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, we see the coming together of two great civilizations. And both coming together, two ways of life, two kinds of thought. She embodied the best of the French, which is where we see the Renaissance work out. And Sri Aurobindo says that about Caesar, that later on, all that Augustus Caesar is regarded as the greatest administrative genius in history. And he says that all his ideas were later taken up by Da Vinci, who is another vibhuti of Sri Aurobindo. And he summarized it. Again, we see that, you know, these ideas were taken up later on. And these are very interesting aspects of history and how she embodied all of that. And then we see Sri Aurobindo taking the genius of the East and going to the West, the mother, the genius of the West, and coming to India and joining together. So it marks a new age where there will be unity. Now, earlier, nature tried to create unity through empires. So we have to understand why empires were created. There was a reason behind it. Nature was trying to create unity. But except for perhaps Augustus Caesar, who allowed a certain amount of liberality, and of course in India, empires carried that multicultural by its very nature. That story I've already spoken about, the Das Rajne Bharat. But otherwise, generally, empires tended to flatten out. The Roman Empire tried but ended up largely flattening out. And of course, British Empire, with it allowed liberal, but again, conversion. Mughal Empire completely, you know, flattened out everything, nothing except the Muslims. But this effort at unity has gone now. Now the age of empires is over. Now is the age of nations. So empires have been broken. That was an age when empires were being formed. So we see Christ coming at a juncture when empires are being formed. Then when an empire converts to Christianity, there is a big, large scale. Even in India, it took place post-Buddha. When an emperor turned towards Buddha, whatever, you know, his deeds may be, Buddha or Mahavir Jain, basically suddenly things, because empires were like that. You touch one point, it will spread very fast. But now is the age of nations. Empires have been broken. And now the unity will not be the unity created by empires, but a unity which will move towards world unity. And each of these nations will bring its own strength, its own beauty, its own culture, and it will create, evolve into a very interesting, we may use the word fusion culture, but that's not a good word, but the best of all the cultures, and the human race as a whole is going to advance. And that's why we cannot understand the ways things are happening today, but I am sure with passage of time we'll see more and more how God has planned his world so wisely. And everything that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have said is going to be true, whatever be the appearances today. So this is the lesson we learn from these events. that wait for a few hundred years. That's what Sri Aurobindo said. He spoke of wait for 300 years. So wait for a few hundred years, and just like the other events, we are going to see at a very large scale, the only word which we can use is a tremendous spiritual revolution, wherein the average man is becoming subtler, more spiritualized, more psychicized, and more intuitive. And this is how I would like to close. Let's wait for the luminous future. Let's prepare ourselves for it, because it is the hour of God. Jai Ma, if there are any questions, I'll be happy to take it. Yeah.
Thank you, Alokji. I think it was very nice to see the events. I had one lot of questions about the seas of Troy and how, what Sri Aurobindo's point of view on that was, because I was trying to read, but I really could not find this collection which you had brought it together very nicely. And also it gives a very different outlook of the world event. I think that helps
yes.
to understand in the range of time, or the long range of time, how things happen. And thanks to obviously Mother Sri Aurobindo that they have provided all this information. Obviously they are in the pockets where you need to go dig and figure it out.
It's amazing. I would say that please read about the Trojan War, read Homer, read Sri Aurobindo's Iliad. It's very fascinating. Very fascinating. Sri Aurobindo's Iliad is like, it covers that period of the war which Homer doesn't touch. So though it's incomplete, because papers were lost, Sri Aurobindo is, this is the one poem which Sri Aurobindo, was dearest to his heart other than Savitri. So he wanted to complete it. But, well, he couldn't. But nevertheless, he completed Savitri, and that's there for us for the new age. Yeah. Sorry for interrupting you. Yeah.
No worries. That's wonderful. Something else which was coming in my mind this morning, and you very eloquently put it together, that collective yoga is the more important than individual yoga. And this thought was coming in my mind this morning to request people here at the foundation, that this year is also the 25th year of the Sri Aurobindo Yoga Foundation, and
wow.
we have to do something different in the sense, I mean, obviously we do the programs, but maybe more collectivity we need to bring together. And if we can form a, for the lack of word, committee, so if anybody wants to participate, bringing the ideas, thinking about what we should do, how we should do, what different we can do, I would request anyone who is interested, please reach out to me, sefna@gmail.com or my cell phone, however you like to, and we try to arrange something so that we can meet more often to discuss and talk about it, what else we can do for the collective. And I see more and more that the center's importance in that perspective is very important. And we had mentioned this earlier in some other time, that all of us individually are working, because we are very close to, all of us very close to Mother, thanks to her grace on everyone. But it's a time that we need to come together as a collective to see what we can bring, what we can work together, not we can bring, whatever brings comes out, it will come out. So if anyone has any question, please ask that question.
That I could hear the last word towards the end. Dr. Alok, he said something like, thanks to faith and the gospel, and because of that we
say, yeah.
Then I didn't hear the last part, but that was a punch word, meaning that saved us what?
I'll just read the full aphorism so that we have directly in the Lord's words. Yeah. So the aphorism goes, it's an aphorism of Sri Aurobindo. They say that the gospels are forgeries and Krishna a creation of the poets. And then comes Sri Aurobindo's punchline with a sense of humor. Thank God then for the forgeries. and bow down before the inventors. So, at another place he speaks the same thing, story of Bhagavad, that they have saved the word, the soul alive. So, that also I'll read out. So, the mother comments that, you know, the writers of the Gospels have tried to reproduce exactly what Christ taught. The Gospels were the starting point of the Christian religion. So, this is about the Gospel, and there is the other one which is about, yes. So, this is the other aphorism where Shobhinda says, some say Krishna never lived. He is a myth. They mean on earth, for if Vrindavan existed nowhere, the Bhagavad could not have been written. And there is a third one which I am searching for, and it's about, you know, thank God to these Gospels, because they have saved the soul of man alive. Now, saved the soul. So basically, I was referring to that, that things which people.
Okay.
Yeah. You got the answer, no? Yeah. Okay. Any other?
No, if no other question. I know it's getting late there, Aruti. So, thank you very much again. And I think Abhilash and Keisha or someone is helping there to make this possible. So, thank you.
Yes, Abhilash is there and Keisha. Yes, you know them.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Thank you everyone for joining, and again, very happy new year. Let's work together in this wonderful year to bring something new from all of us, whatever we can bring it up in the service of Mother and Shrivindu, and that itself will do wonders for all of us. Thank you again, everyone.
Thank you, and a very, very wonderful new year.
Thank you.
Full of her light and love and peace. Yes. Jai Ma.
Recording stopped.
Jai Ma.
Jai Ma. Jai Ma. Jai Ma.